up. Once again, this is WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Everybody, Kev O'Donohue and Julian Joyello, back with you with the Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and some guests to try and help you lead a more positively minded life. And we know that if you do not sleep well, you will not have a positively minded life, because you need to be able to take control of your mind in order to live positively. And if you can't do that with sleep deprivation, it makes life pretty close to impossible.
Absolutely.
And so today we have a guest. We have a sleep technologist and a longtime associate of the DeMille Center and now the Positive Mind Center, Stephanie Dombra, who is an expert on sleep and is currently going to tell us all about her status in studying sleep. And we're going to cover a lot of topics today. So you're really going to want to tune in. And we're going to end with talking about ways to get a good night's sleep. So, Stephanie, welcome back to The Positive Mind.
Hi, Kevin.
Nice to see
you. Very nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Great to have you.
Yes, it's awesome.
So tell people what you're doing, what you're studying.
Okay. I'm sure that there are many listeners from the past that know who I am.
Yes.
And I've been at the center for 14 years,
right,
Kevin, so it's been a while.
And you were on the show for 5 years?
Seven years.
Every day.
Well, when we were on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, yes. So what I've been doing the last 5 years, in a very kind of slow fashion, every semester I've taken a class, and there is an actual associate's degree now. In New York State, they require sleep technologists, and the fancy term is polysomnographist, which means poly means many, som means sleep, and graphy means recording.
Hmm.
These are people that actually get trained so that they can work in a sleep lab to help people that have sleep disorders, and specifically, you know, a lot of people probably understand this, and we'll get into that, is sleep apnea. Mm. So for the last 5 years, I've been taking classes online and at community colleges to get this degree in applied science. It's a 60-credit program, so I just took a course every semester. And I'm at the end, because now I'm at this hospital called St. Charles in Port Jefferson on Long Island, and I do my clinical work at the lab. And so overnight, I actually am working at the lab, helping, you know, with the staff, and I'm being trained to be a sleep technologist.
So you see all stages of sleep. You see people hooked up to machines, hooked
yes.
up to wires.
Yes, EEGs. Those are the electrodes that determine what stage of sleep a person is in, what the brain waves are. They're assessing how the person's, you know, their breathing patterns, their EKG, which is heart patterns, and all sorts of muscle patterns on their legs and their chin.
And we know the importance of this studying, because, you know, we hear every 3 months about a railroad electrician, an engineer.
That's right.
Or a pilot, or somebody who's sleep deprived.
Yes.
You know, who is causing a lot of deaths for people.
And most of those people actually do have sleep apnea. They're falling asleep on the job. And I was telling you earlier
yeah.
that the all the different, you know, MTA is doing actual studies where people who have a certain neck circumference, this is a very important way that people are determining whether or not they're at risk for sleep apnea. So the MTA is requiring their drivers to actually go for a test to see how thick their neck circumference is,
right?
Because they may be at risk for sleep apnea. Yeah.
There's so many factors when it comes into sleeping, to getting a good sleep.
That's right. So when people have sleep apnea, so I can explain exactly what that is, you are actually stopping breathing while you're sleeping.
We want to go into that, but I also want to highlight that insurance companies now are recognizing this and trying to be proactive to prevent lawsuits, that they're having people with a certain neck size come in and have to take a sleep study.
Yes.
Wow. So what is the neck size? Just
it's,
so I
it's
know.
Probably like over 17
Everybody
and a half
tape
inches.
Everybody gets their measures out at home. They go, okay.
I mean, obviously people that have obesity and that are overweight and inactive are potentially going to be at more risk for sleep apnea, which is when the airway of our, neck area closes up. So that's why we are not able to breathe. And that is a very big issue right now. A lot of people are experiencing that. And it's loud snoring and then loud snoring with gasping. And that's one of the things that people are key. You can see that they actually stop breathing.
So before we go into that, I mean, we want to recognize also that it's not just people with thick necks that are having a hard night's sleep or a bad night's sleep.
Yes.
You know, there are over 60 million prescriptions for Ambien in the U.S. alone.
That's right.
Alone. I mean, how many adults are there in the U.S.? Maybe 200 million?
Yes.
So one in three or four are taking Ambien or a sleep aid.
That's right.
You know, and how has it gotten to this? How have we gotten to the place? And I know, I think that sleep disordered sleep is more common than orderly sleep. When I hear somebody
I
sleep like a baby, if they're over 30 and they tell me they sleep like a baby, I'm so envious. It's like a
dream. And I think
that's
the majority of people are pretty envious of those who can sleep.
Particularly in New York City.
Yeah.
I think we live in such a fast-paced, stressful environment. And if you don't know how to turn that off before you go into bed.
Right. It seeps right into your bedtime. Your sleep.
You're in fight or flight all the time, as we were saying, Kevin.
Right.
You know, and you don't know how to turn off that part of the brain.
Why don't we start off this conversation by figuring out what exactly the main importance hormonally, what is happening when we get a good night of sleep, and what is happening when we don't get a good night of sleep in the body.
Yeah. Right. So I think that the function of sleep, there have been a lot of theories around it, and the one that's very important is that when we sleep, all the different organs are obviously always going. They have to be continuing to function in order to serve us. But the brain is a very specific kind of organ that needs to clean house, so to speak. And so in our brains, we are basically like making so many connections. We have 10,000 trillion connections or synapses going on in our brains. If we didn't sleep, and sleep is profound for cleaning house, meaning pruning back all these connections that are not necessary. Some things are important that we need to learn. But in our active day, we are constantly making all these connections. If we didn't sleep to clean up all the unnecessary things, we'd be overwhelmed.
So we could think of sleeping, a good night's sleep, kind of taking everything in the office and filing it into the direct cabinet, shredding the things we don't need.
Shredding
is a good one. Moving
the
things that we do into the right places so that the next day comes along and we know where it is. Our brain is settled and ready to learn new things and experience new.
It helps prune back. The sleep allows us to dream, which is a very important part, which we'll get into. But we need to try to forget things. We need to try to remember things. And sleep allows us to do that.
There's a reason why it's the number one torture around the world. Sleep deprivation.
It's true.
Right? I mean, after two nights of sleep, missed sleep. You know, to say you become irritable, it would be an understatement. I mean, what happens after 5 days of not sleeping?
Well, when we were talking earlier, I said that there are three pillars of health. And obviously there are more in between that. But the three are sleep, nutrition, and exercise. Exercise and nutrition we could sort of get away with. We could, eat certain foods and we don't have to be like crazy about it. But sleep. If we don't sleep after 11 days, we are probably going to die. And even before that, we're going to get psychotic.
Right. When you look at just animals in the wild, how often they sleep and how much they sleep when they can, their survival instincts are fed by that sleep. They need that. And it's such a basic function of surviving as an animal.
Why don't people take it more seriously?
Because they want to get everything done. I think we, again, in years past, there used to be what was called two sleeps, like two stages of sleep. So people, we had all this kind of activity when we were on the farm and doing all those things. As soon as it would get dark, we would be asleep by like 8 o'clock because, you know, between 8 and 9, it was dark.
You couldn't do stuff.
We didn't have electricity. We didn't have lights. Yeah. So we went to sleep when it was dark. And then maybe we'd wake up again at like 1 or 2 in the morning.
Right.
And people would do all sorts of interesting things between 1 and 2. They'd create, they'd write, they'd have sex, they'd do all sorts of interesting things, and then they'd go back to sleep again. So there was like, it's called like two sleep. I'm not sure exactly the term. And so when technology happened and the Industrial Revolution came, we started to just feel like we had to produce and keep going with all sorts of ideas and activities. And now we're at the stage where it's 24/7. Nonstop. So I think that it's worse. I don't know that people back then, you know, slept so long and didn't have problems, but we didn't have the medications. We didn't have all these kind of
With the prevalence of Adderall amongst young people. I mean, constantly keeping your brain moving and utilizing and overutilizing your time.
Yeah, overstimulated.
Yeah, I mean, and especially in a place like New York City. I mean,
it's
just when you look around, you say, okay, well, this is open 24/7, so I'm going to go there here, and I'm going to do this now, and I'm going to get this done before this time. And there's a lot more of like, how can I be efficient with my time, and is sleep worth it to a lot of people?
I know. People, you know the phrase, I'm sure. People say, I'll sleep when I die. You're going to die if you don't sleep, is what I say.
You shouldn't think of it as an option to not sleep.
It should be a joy, and like you want to jump into bed. I know when I always used to talk, and I still do with my daughter, we always say, Mom, I just can't wait to dive into bed. We're so excited to go to sleep.
Right.
That's how
I
am.
Having that feeling. I mean, people have lost that feeling.
They
just pass out now.
Right.
You know, and they'll do
or
an
they
interrupted sleep.
Out,
or they knock themselves out. So they're not so conscious of what it takes to get a good night's sleep. So, and this is the thing. I'm sorry about having a positive mind. Yeah. I mean, this is something you can take control of. You know, you might not be able to control your partner. You might not be able to control your job. There are things in your life that are causing you stress that you might not, you know, might take some time to get a handle on. Sleeping, you can take charge of. So if you're irritable all the time, there's a good signal that you're probably not sleeping well.
Well, yeah. And speaking about that irritability, what happens when you're sleep deprived? Irritability, we have...
gain weight.
We have weight gain. We have loss
problems.
Of short-term memory type stuff because things aren't hanging around. Diabetes. I mean, there's all kinds of essentially everything coming out that's negative. It comes kind of, it starts at the lack of sleep area.
It makes sense that it's a pillar, one of the three pillars.
It is. It is. It's actually the foundation.
Yeah, and I think everybody knows what habits they're doing that are contributing to not having a good night's sleep. We're going to give people remedies at the end. I'm going to give one right now. If you wake up in the middle of the night, you should read a difficult book. You should not read like a novel or something. You should get out your old science textbook and start reading that.
Just
but we're going to throw in some doodads along the way. But that's it. Because the brain will just not be able to hold it. And it will fall back into sleep. Mm. Whereas if you're reading a romance novel.
That's engaging.
It might be too engaging.
But you see mostly sleep apnea people.
Mostly.
What happens with sleep apnea?
Okay, so sleep apnea, as I was saying, is when we fall asleep, and we're in a more relaxed state, the muscle tone in our airway closes up. And obviously when we're, you know, overweight, the muscle tone gets even like fattier, so to speak. So there's more fat around that area and it closes up the airway. It blocks the ability to let the oxygen pass and our breath. So what happens is if a person has sleep apnea, they will fall asleep and then they'll start to snore, and then the pauses in breathing occur, and they actually lose oxygen. And we don't want oxygen to be lost. The brain needs oxygen.
Right.
So I have actually witnessed, while I'm at the lab, we have a computer software program, and we're looking at a screen because the person is, it's like a hotel room. They're inside the hotel room, so to speak, and they're hooked up, and then all the connections come into a main control room, so to speak, and we can monitor them all night long. So we can actually see, let's say, a person could stop breathing for 60 seconds. and you see a flat line on the program.
So my God.
It's scary.
That's terrifying.
It's like they're resuscitating themselves. Wow. So when they are diagnosed with sleep apnea, what then happens is if they make a certain amount of, you know, like there's a apnea, it's called an apnea hypopnea index. And if they reach a certain level, then the insurance companies will say, okay, you have sleep apnea. You qualify for getting what's called a continuous positive airway pressure mask.
A CPAP. Okay.
So they get fitted for this mask. They come back to a lab and then they get fitted for a mask. And during that second night that they come back, they then wear the mask and we watch them sleep again. And this time you can see that they've basically eliminated the apnea, you hope. Right. But enough so that they start getting really good sleep.
And what kind of, what comes of these new sleeping habits for these people with sleep apnea? Right after this cure sort of happens, how does their life change?
It does. It's almost automatic. That's uh-huh. what's scary. Like when people come to the lab and they actually get fitted for this mask, yeah. the next morning if I'm there, they say, My allergies cleared up. I can breathe. My nasal passages. My sleep was good, and we could see it because we can actually see them going into what's called REM sleep, which we'll get into, and the quality is different. So they have more energy. And one of the key symptoms for people that have sleep apnea, it's called excessive daytime sleepiness. Mm. They are really not functioning well. They're kind of half asleep when they're at the job or something. So their energy levels come back and they function at a different level.
Right. It's got to be an important question for a pilot. I mean, when you're hiring pilots or engineers or people who are running massive machinery, a UPS truck driver, I mean,
absolutely.
You need to ask them.
They should almost be tested for that.
They are now. They really
now.
Are.
Okay, good.
Like we know MTA, that they are testing, you know, a lot of these accidents, actually they have been proven that it's sleep apnea.
Here's a little gem. What hours of the day are the most car accidents?
Well, it depends. I mean, those semi-tractor trailer drivers.
Between 2 and 4 p.m.
Every day.
P.m.? 2 and 4
2
p.m.
in the afternoon.
Yeah.
2 to 4 in the afternoon.
And that's when the
most
people
car
who
accidents
are,
happen. You would think in the morning.
It would be the people who are most sleep deprived when they get really, really tired.
Yeah, but throw on top of that that the body temperature
that's
drops
right,
in the middle of the day. Mm. It also drops at night, but it drops in the middle of the day for everybody. So if you find yourself sleepy and you haven't eaten, you know, don't think that, you know, it's because you haven't eaten. Or even if you have eaten, I've often attributed need for sleep after a meal.
That's right.
But it's often not. It's often just that your temperature of your body's gone down and your body wants to shut down.
Yeah, I remember back in high school, before I started drinking coffee, it was a class around 2:30 p.m.
Yeah.
And every single time I would fall asleep. Every single time.
I wonder if that's why they have siestas in Europe, you know, between 2 and 4.
Exactly.
That must be the benefit in Spain and Italy, right?
Right. But we have all of our truckers trucking at between 2 and 4 p.m. So making sure that they're at least doing their part, everybody's there's no way to control your body temperature, but there is a way to control your night's sleep. So I would think it's important on an interview to ask a potential employee, how do you sleep at night? Does your partner complain about how you sleep?
That's right. And there are sleep tests, surveys, you know, there's one that's called the Epworth survey, and there's Stanford, which is like the
Stanford University.
Stanford is
like
the
gold
the
standard
of sleep medicine, yes. Yeah. Mm. And so, yes, you can actually start to hand out all these things to all these types of individuals who are in these types of jobs.
How does somebody know if they have it? I mean, frequently you were saying that spouses bring their husbands and say, okay, that's it. I want you to get tested. But, I mean, what if you're a bachelor and you get tired 5 times a day?
Well, again, if a doctor nowadays, I think up until maybe even 5 years ago, physicians were not asking the question. They really weren't assessing. I think that should be a standard thing now, that physicians ask the question about sleep apnea. Not that they're going to say, do you have sleep apnea? They're going to ask questions about the person's sleep behaviors and sleep problems.
Right.
And then they can recommend them to go for a study. They're going to ask questions about snoring. They're going to ask questions about their excessive daytime sleepiness.
Is there a cheaper way to go? I mean, that's a lot of money to go to a sleep lab. I mean,
The insurance companies.
Can I tape myself
right.
at night?
Well, again, you can, but you still have to get the treatment.
Right.
Okay.
Of course.
But the insurance companies nowadays, because they were spending a lot of money to all these different labs and doctors and hospitals, giving each patient that was going to a lab like $6,000, crazy amounts of money.
Just for one night's sleep.
Just to watch them for one night. Yeah. But now the insurance companies are trying to get the patients to have home sleep tests. So they take this equipment, which is an abbreviated version of what happens at a sleep lab, and then they can go home in their, you know, comfort of their own home and have that test done at home.
Yeah, that's really interesting stuff. I'd love to talk more about the actual stages of sleep and sort of give to the audience a bit of information about what's happening when you're sleeping right. What is happening in your body? You know, what happens when you wake up at 3:30 in the morning and you're like, what's going on? Like, why am I awake right now? What is it? Is it the bathroom? Is it some kind of middle of cycle experience? What's happening?
Yeah.
Right. So we sleep, we have four stages of sleep.
Right.
So when we get a little bit tired, and we can talk about this melatonin issue, because that kind of comes up with this stage. Mm-hmm. When it gets dark out, or if we're really conscious of this, we turn out our lights or we change our setting in our home to make sure that we don't have all these bright lights on.
Right.
Our body naturally will start to get tired, because in the brain there's a gland called the pineal gland or pineal. Mm-hmm. And it releases, in the dark, melatonin. And melatonin is our natural kind of chemical neurotransmitter that allows the brain and the body to say, it's time to go to bed.
Yeah, and I know some people who take an artificial melatonin to try to force themselves into feeling. I don't know
how beneficial those are. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So then when we do finally get sleepy, or hopefully we just go to bed because we know it's time to go to bed.
Right.
We go into what's the first stage is N1. That's non, which means N means non, stage one. And that period of time is usually between like 1 minute and 7 or 8 minutes, if you're basically an average sleeper.
And so you're also changing your brain waves.
The brain waves are changed.
In
the daytime, we are very active, and we usually are involved with beta waves.
Right.
And that brain waves means the speed with which our brain is electrically, you know, active.
Right, right.
And also the height of the brain
wave. And you're actually seeing this on the screen.
Absolutely.
When somebody comes in, they're in beta.
Yeah.
And you see the activity.
Yes.
The chemical, electrical activity.
The electrical activity. And then when they move into N1,
right,
that's when they're moving into what's called theta. So alpha and theta are the brain waves of N1.
Got it.
And then when they move from N1, they go into N2.
So N1 being the process of going to sleep.
Exactly.
It's
falling.
Sort of that moment when you're lying down, you're tucked in, you close your eyes and you say, okay, I'm going to go to sleep now.
That's right.
Okay.
And you're starting to get some images or something?
Images, exactly.
Right.
Maybe it starts getting a little more visual, happening.
Right.
Maybe go into some kind of story or something like that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
As an aside, there was, I think it was Picasso, they said that he used to take these short naps, and he would hold a pencil in his hand. And when the pencil would drop, he'd wake himself up. And that was in N1 stage, because then he'd get all these interesting images. And that's how he would create.
That's cool.
When he was a starving artist.
Right.
And so then N2 is?
It's the next, it goes into a deeper sleep stage, which is more of theta waves, but slower, a little bit slower
and
than
alpha.
And
you can see that on the screen.
Slower waves. Mm-hmm. And then there's very interesting things that happen. And there are two key things. They're K complexes. It's very interesting. It looks like a K on the screen. And then sleep spindles. And those are very rapid oscillating waves.
Okay, so we're visualizing right now the graph which you would be watching when you were in the EEG room, where you would be measuring someone sleeping. So
that's
we're seeing N1 stage, going to sleep. There's more beta,
alpha, theta, and then it moves to theta
in N2.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so this sort of points out for that this person that they're going into a deeper place of sleep. They're not conscious anymore.
They're not conscious anymore.
Right. Yeah.
They're not
right.
conscious.
So
anymore.
We as sleep technologists have to learn how to score a sleep study, which is something that I do a lot.
So you say, here's when stage two started.
Exactly, because I saw a K complex or I saw a sleep spindle, so I could see that they moved into that stage.
Interesting. So N2 will come about after, for a healthy person, after 1 to 8 minutes of eyes closed, trying to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
they just sort of, that's the time when everything goes black and we wake up the next day. So there's N2, and then what comes after that?
Usually, we have sleep cycles in an ideal world, 90-minute sleep cycles.
Right.
So we're going into, from N2, we go into N3. And in the beginning of the night, the first part of the night, we have more N3, which is delta sleep. Those are slow wave sleeps, and that's deep sleep.
And that lasts longer than REM that you're going to be talking about in a minute? It sounds like it must.
It can for young people.
Okay.
Young people have more deep sleep than older people.
Right.
Okay, so we do go through all the four stages in the 90-minute cycle.
Got it.
But what happens is N3 is more in the first part of the night, and then our REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement, is in the latter part
and
of the
night. And that's the time when you're paralyzed.
That's right. REM
is in your own body.
That's right.
Yeah.
Say more about that. What do you mean you're paralyzed?
Right. So after
N3. The other stages I'm not paralyzed?
No.
I can move around and thrash?
No, we move around a little bit. We don't move that much. Again, if everything is working properly, we're not moving a lot and having a lot of arousals.
Right.
But when we go into rapid eye movement, which is called REM sleep.
Which would be around N4? You said?
Well, it's the fourth stage.
It's the fourth stage. No N.
There is no four. All the others are not REMs.
That's right.
So N1, N2, N3, which is delta, and then we hit REM sleep, which is around the last 30 minutes of the 90-minute cycle? About.
An ideal thing. People that, again, have problems don't always do this. And I can talk about that later.
Sure.
So in REM, as you said, Julian, this is very important. We are functionally paralyzed, except for our arm movements.
Mm.
And the reason why we're paralyzed is because this is the time. We do dream in the other stages, but in rapid eye movement sleep, we are actively dreaming. We have vivid things going on. We have action. We're trying to run anyway, as you all probably remember.
It's very tough to do whatever you want to do.
But that's because we're paralyzed.
Yeah.
So that's what is...
Is there a safety reason? I mean, why would you...
Yes, because if we acted out those things...
Oh, I see. Okay.
Then we would be hurting.
Yeah, our body says, let's lock you down so you don't run into the wall and smash your head.
And if you've ever woken up out of a nightmare, you can often see, oh gosh, I feel paralyzed.
Right.
I mean, I can recognize that.
Well that's actually called sleep paralysis.
Sleep paralysis is pretty common, actually. I know several people who experience that pretty often, which is quite scary. You wake up in the middle of that paralysis and you can't move for 10 or 15 minutes.
And that's from REM.
And so why would that happen to somebody, for example?
A lot of times I find, first of all, sleep paralysis is part of what's called narcolepsy.
Mm-hmm.
Narcolepsy is a sleep disorder that you have such excessive daytime sleepiness that you actually fall asleep.
Of course.
Yeah.
But it's also, so is it a genetic thing or is it a biological thing?
No, it probably is genetic, but what's going on is that in the hypothalamus, there's a very specific chemical called hypocretin. It's a neurochemical.
Okay.
And when people have narcolepsy, they don't have any of that being produced. They've done, at Stanford, they did years ago.
So it's a very specific hormone missing.
Oh, very, very specific chemical.
So we're going to take a musical break shortly, but I did want to finish on the REM and then tell people, it's not the hours that you sleep, though. It's the cycles that you go through.
And
the 90-minute cycles.
Right.
You don't want to wake up after 80 minutes of sleep because then you're going to wake up, that's interrupting the full cycle.
Right.
And they've done studies on this. If you wake people up before they finish a cycle, they're going to be exhausted during the day. So it's not amount of how many hours of sleep you get per night, even though, you know, adults get between 7 and 9 hours.
Right.
And 7.5 hours is five cycles.
Yeah, I was about to say, so if we were doing these perfect 90-minute cycles and they were going perfectly and you were every 90 minutes, you go through all four stages, you'd hit your alpha and your theta and your delta and then your REM and then again and again and again, you would do five of those cycles and then you'd wake up fully healthy, essentially 7.5 hours or 9 hours, I guess.
And you want
to
set your clock. You want to set your clock
to fit
your
cycle.
Sleep cycle. You really do.
Yeah. Right. So if you're going to sleep and you have 6 hours of sleep coming up, you want to hit all four stages, right?
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
Because you've only got 6 hours and you've got to get those 90 minute and hopefully they kind of link up correctly.
But if you don't need an alarm, and I know most people sleep and have to wake up with an alarm, but if you don't, your body will naturally do it.
Right.
It'll wake up when it's finished its cycle.
Right.
Right. And I think as you get older, you wake up. I know that I wake up every night. And I mean, it's just, and I go right back to sleep. But I do wake up for that minute. I can see the clock, and it is
because
an actual
moving.
Hour and a half. And
that's
right.
So, I mean, we all wake up. But, you know, when you're younger, you just don't recognize it. You slide back into a new cycle.
Yeah.
And anyway, we're going to take a music break.
Yeah, it's coming to 1:30 p.m. here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. You're listening to The Positive Mind with Kevin O'Donohue, myself, Julian Joiello, and Stephanie Dombra. We're talking about sleep and the many, many secrets and things to learn.
Here's
going to be a lot more secrets coming
Why
after
warm
the break.
Milk?
Why warm milk? Think about
it. It still
that.
Works.
We're going to play a little music here.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him two lips like roses and clover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Don't have nobody to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Don't have nobody to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam. Oh, Mr. Sandman. Mr. Sandman.
Yes?
Bring us a dream. Give him a pair of eyes with a come hither gleam. Give him a lonely heart like Pagliacci. And lots of wavy hair like Liberace. Mr. Sandman, someone to hold. Before we're too old. So please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring us. Please, 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 Mr. Sandman, bring us a dream.
And that was Mr. Sandman by the Cordettes. I think everybody knows that one.
I love that.
It's great.
Let's talk about dreams. Right? Because that's in there.
Yes.
Mr. Sandman, send us some dreams.
God, dreams are so interesting.
I have to say personally that, you know, dreams have changed my life. I mean, I have made decisions, big decisions, based on a dream.
I think
waking up
do.
Out of a dream. Yeah. I was shocked. I mean, you know, you struggle with something for months and months, and then finally you wake up and you say, I'm going to change that career.
And a lot of people look at the significance of a dream and say, what does this mean? Does it link to something else? It almost always does in some shape or form. I mean, I don't know too much about it, but I know I have a lot of friends who go to sleep dictionaries and they go, look, what does this snake mean?
Really?
Does it mean that I'm poisoned
but
inside?
But what I'm talking about is like an inner knowing. You don't even need to analyze it. I don't need to know the symbolics. I know, this is telling me I have to change my life.
Right.
And so tell us about dreams. Does dreaming is, because we were going to link back to REM, is that where the dreaming is taking place in REM?
Mostly in REM.
And what is the importance of dreams? The function of dreams?
Well, again, going back to, I know you mentioned the symbolic stuff, and I know that, you know, the audience might know this, that Freud made a lot of stink about dreams, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it was really about this idea that if you have these dreams, that you're working out these unconscious wishes. One of the theories of dreams is that we dream to fulfill our wishes.
Right.
Consummate a wish.
Right. And the idea back then when he was coming up with his ideas was that, you know, you dream and all those symbolic images are important, and that somehow when you come to the analyst, you bring up those images and they're in that latent content, you're going to find meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So You know, that was the theory at the time. I don't think that that's actually what's going on in this day and age.
No.
People don't really believe that.
Right.
But what we do with dreaming is very important because, again, it's based on this kind of memory issue. And, of course, one of the theories is we do resolve problems when we dream. So just like you said, you might be able to think of a problem, sleep on it, and come up with something. And big ideas. This chemist came up with the benzene molecule image in his dream, and he was able to resolve some kind of issue of, you know, what's the compound or what's the structure of the benzene.
Right. It doesn't change that perhaps in your dreams there are very creative things happening.
There are creative things happening, absolutely. But it's, I don't know that it's psychologically.
Right. We don't know for sure. I mean, maybe it could hold some significance in some way for
But you said consolidate.
This is the point that they think that dreams are very important because it helps our memories. It helps us to forget, and it helps us to remember.
Right.
So when we're dreaming, what's happening is that we're and it's not about the images. When we're sleeping, something about the dreams helps us remember, like the task or whatever was going on. So one it's not even so much a theory, but like if, let's say, we're taught a certain task that's challenging in the day.
Right.
And then we go to sleep or we take a nap and we are thinking about that task. It turns out the next day when we do that task, we are actually even better at it because we've dreamt on that task.
Right, and I mentioned, we were talking about this before. I, as many of you know, I'm an actor, and in the acting career life of things, you have to learn lots of lines, lots and lots and lots of lines. And there were days sometimes when I was doing my show where we had to do 15 to 20 pages of lines the next day, every day. And to learn that amount of lines, I learned over time that it's just impossible unless it's done right before you go to bed. Or not just directly before you go to bed, but you must sleep on information that is going on. So I could learn all my lines. I could say, I'm memorized, I'm good. But if I do it the day of and I never get any sleep in between the act of doing it, it never really makes it into my body. Yeah, and as an actor, it is the memory has to be cemented in your body because it's physical. It comes out. You can't be thinking while you're acting. It has to just come naturally. And so one of the biggest secrets for memorizing for most actors is if you have a day extra to do it before so that you can sleep on it, wake up the next day, and it moves into a different kind of place. It feels more like it's moved into the long-term memory.
Is this well-known? Do a lot of actors do this?
Not every actor. I mean, every actor has their own kind of way of doing it, but I have to say most of my friends who are actors are like, oh, yeah. I mean, if somebody gives me an audition, you know, a day before, I usually actually ask for two so that I have two nights of sleep because I do it the first night, I sleep the first night on it, and then I do it again the next day, it's much more there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second night, it's like, it's fully realized that you really
And you can even do it with a nap.
Yeah.
That's one of the tests that a research...
Really interesting.
Very well-known sleep researcher from Harvard. His name is Robert Stickold, and he writes about these things, and they carried out studies. Just by napping, by giving a person a challenging kind of task.
Memorizational task?
Or even if it was like probably on the computer in this day and age, that they were challenged to see if they could get through a complicated maze. That was the study. Mm-hmm. And then they separated the group of research subjects in three groups. One group was given the task to do the maze, then take a nap and think about doing the maze in their nap.
Mm-hmm.
The second group was told to just go to sleep and take a nap, not think about anything. Mm-hmm. And then the third group was not given a nap.
So the group who was told to think about the maze while napping, was it sort of like in that N1 stage one of going to sleep, they were like thinking about the maze and then it sort of moved into their dreams or something, or into their nap?
It probably did, Julian. Mm-hmm. I mean, because usually when you nap in the afternoon, you're not really going into deep sleep.
And you don't really
sleep.
Want to go into deep, deep sleep with a nap.
So you're essentially going into a hyper-focused unconscious place.
A micro nap, yes.
Ooh, no. Micro nap.
All naps should be micro. I mean, shouldn't they? I mean, they
so not for
they
kids, have it, not have, for
they,
little
they
ones.
They have it down to 17 or 18 minutes. Right, for kids... That's a different story.
So what's
story,
toddlers?
What is
we
a
adults.
Micro nap? The extent of it, how long it is, what does it do, what is it for? Tell us.
7 to 10 minutes.
Seven to 10 minutes.
You
of
just
sleep.
Have to give in to the tiredness.
You have to keep. You have to stop saying sleep because you're not really sleeping. Mm. You're napping. Napping is different than sleeping. Sleeping is you're starting to get into the.
Full cycle.
So it's almost like when you nod off for 5 or 10 minutes.
No,
and
that's
come
different
back.
Too. It's okay. Not
no, no, nodding off is like a micro nap.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yes.
Because nap has to be a deliberate thing, isn't it?
Well, I mean, obviously,
I
you know,
off
like
all the time.
You, so, okay. So, but that's not bad. It really isn't.
Well,
people,
Edison used to nap, you know, 20 times a day. You know, he would go for talk about micro naps. I mean, he had so many projects going, he would nap and then wake up and work till 4 in the morning.
So what is the significance of this 7 to 10 minute nap?
You're not allowing your body. Some people that are so sleep deprived and tired will fall asleep, and they will sleep for 2 hours in the middle of the afternoon, and that disrupts your nighttime sleep.
Right.
There you go.
So micro napping, if you, you know, obviously you could sleep for 30 minutes, but I find if I just allow, if I'm home, for instance, and I'm tired, I just go lay down, and in 7 minutes, I'm back up.
Do you set an alarm?
No, nothing. I never even get past that N1 stage. Mm-hmm. I know I'm not, but I'm refreshing myself, and I'm giving into the tiredness. That's all it really is.
I think if you polled most CEOs in most companies, they would say the secret of success is napping.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think, you know, most CEOs could go full days without taking some moments either to do some breath, focus on the breath.
I have to say, from the acting world, it's a requirement in a theater to have a cot in the back of the backstage. There has to be
a union requirement.
A union requirement that there's a small cot so that people can take naps if they need to.
Let's take this to PTSD.
Okay,
because you mentioned about dreams and actually interrupting sleep with veterans or people that have suffered a trauma that day. Let's say you're experiencing the trauma that day. What is the secret? What do you do?
Right. Well, the theory is, it's not really actually a theory anymore, but going back to the dream, when we dream, we are consolidating the memory. So it goes from short-term memory to long-term memory. Right. I don't need to get into the particulars of the science. So the theory is, and people have been talking about this for years, that we always thought that when someone went through a very big trauma,
right,
that they needed to talk about it and go over it and debrief. Mm-hmm. But when you do that, you are making that memory get implanted into the brain. And then if you go to sleep, you are implanting that even further.
So if you spoke about it for a while and implanted into the long term and then you slept on it, you're actually sort of being counterintuitive
towards
getting rid of that trauma.
You're actually now that the idea is to not go to sleep after a trauma.
Wow.
So they're doing this with veterans in the field who are suffering traumas in battle, that they'll process it that night and they won't let them go to sleep.
Wow.
Right. And and I know you and I have talked about this. There's also another mechanism, and it's a blood pressure mechanism. It's called beta blockers.
Right.
And that medication,
propranolol. Yeah.
That medication allows the body to calm down and not be in fight or flight and have all that adrenaline and all that emotionality going on after you have an event. And that way, you might remember the event, but you won't have all the emotional kind of reaction and stress.
It's almost like waking REM sleep. You mean you're actually seeing it in live without having the reaction to it, the physical paralysis of it.
Right.
So this beta blocker allows for that.
So those are the
two new developments
of how to handle post-traumatic. Don't go to sleep.
Right.
And
even
or
like a car accident, right? If you're in a car
accident,
right?
Exactly.
Any basic trauma that
you would suggest that if somebody went through some kind of physical trauma, they hurt themselves or something, you would suggest that they actually stay up longer that
night
and try not to sleep.
Just one night.
Miss one cycle.
So miss one night of sleep. Yeah. And then if they go to sleep the next day, it actually sort of fades more and it doesn't sit in the body for as long.
That's right.
Wow.
Yep.
How interesting.
And one recent kind of thing that I came across is that actually if there's also one night of sleep deprivation and you're up all night, it helps depression. And that's also because there's this whole idea that these cells in the brain are doing something to, like, increase your mood and your behavior, and it helps.
Say this again. For standard depression, what do you do?
Obviously.
Sleep-wise.
Sleep-wise. Yeah. I mean, obviously with depression, most people are hypersomnial. You know, sleeping way too much.
Right.
But tell me about this again.
Just one night, you have to remember it's a one night treatment. That if you have depression, they're just noticing that it helps with depression if you just stay up, and they're trying to come up with new treatments, and it's related to, again, this is a term that I can't go into, but there are very important cells in the brain called glial cells.
Glial, different than the L.
Yes. Okay. Glial cells do a lot of things in terms of this housekeeping.
Right.
And something about glial cells, if you don't have any sleep, they are abundant in your brain.
Okay.
And that somehow helps the mood. So rather than obviously give people like the treatment of don't sleep, they're trying to study and come up with a mechanism that can mimic that.
Wow.
As opposed to these SSRIs and all these antidepressants that take 6 weeks to work.
Watch out. Pharmaceutical companies, watch out.
Right.
People are going to miss a night of sleep and stop taking your pill.
Right.
Well, yeah, because serotonin interrupts these sleep cycles also. I mean, if you give people an SSRI or an anxiolytic, like a Xanax or something for anxiety.
Yes. SSRIs actually, and that's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are used for anxiety
Prozac,
and depression.
All Zoloft. Those.
Yes. They depress or suppress REM sleep. And we really need that REM sleep. We need it for our dreams. We need it for, all the memories that I'm talking about and learning and cognitive functions. So when you suppress REM sleep, that's not good.
Right.
So that's a very important thing.
So between Ambien and SSRIs, I mean, the country is really playing hockey with their brain chemistry to try and get a good night's sleep.
It's
and
not
get
quality themselves. Sleep.
No kidding.
And, get their brain chemistry in order. Right. When following these three pillars, sleep, nutrition, and exercise can often do the trick. And now we're learning some deprivation, sleep deprivation can actually help.
Right, so a selective night of sleep deprivation could potentially help with avoiding PTSD and avoiding perhaps depression symptoms.
Yes.
Very, very interesting.
Yes.
Very interesting.
We're going to talk about one more thing, and then we're going to talk about hygiene, right?
Ooh, okay.
Sleep hygiene.
Sleep showers.
Right.
Have you guys done it? No.
Because insomnia is quite a phenomenon.
If anybody
who has suffered with insomnia, I've had two bouts of insomnia in my life, and it is such a phenomenon. It's like a you're craving sleep, your whole body and your soul. You keep looking at the clock. It's 1 o'clock. Oh, maybe by two I'll get, maybe it's 4 o'clock. You keep negotiating. Mm. And then you get close to the cliff of sleep, and then right just pops you out of it. Tell us about what causes this.
Well, I mean, again, I think it's probably mostly in our day and age, it's related to the overstimulated mind and being so stressed and too active all the time and not doing all the appropriate things to stay regular with your sleep. Just as an aside, there is an actual phenomenon with very, luckily, very few people, but it's called fatal familial insomnia. 40 families in the world have this. These are families that genetically are linked, and they cannot sleep, and they ultimately die. It's really sad, but it's true.
And it's but they keep propagating. I mean, these families.
So they have no ability to sleep.
They cannot sleep. They cannot sleep.
Ever?
Family, familial.
Wow. So there's 40 families, you said?
In the world.
40 families in the world.
It's that, luckily low in incidence, but it is phenomenal that this is a genetic.
Right, I can't imagine evolutionarily that would stick around, the gene.
Right, because who's going to be propagating?
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yes, okay. So insomnia can be very difficult to handle.
Right.
And in this day and age, I do believe it's probably because of the schedules.
And that, it's a byproduct
and perhaps,
of anxiety.
Perhaps the immense amount of artificial light and stimulation sort of involved in everyday life. I mean, I know this is a little bit separate, but I know on the way to work and on the way home from work, an average New Yorker sees something like 4,000 ads. So you've got like lights and billboards and videos and TVs and your phone and your watch and your computer constantly flying at you. And especially when it's right when you're about to go to bed, the light from the screen physically makes it more difficult for you to go to sleep.
Sure.
And people my age, for example, I'm 24, people my age sleep with their phone on their bed because they use it every night right before they go to bed.
And it's lit up.
And it's lit up, and it's sometimes they leave it up so they can see it if they want to wake up in the middle of the night and answer somebody or something, and it's like, that's not sleep.
But here's the thing with insomnia. You can do everything right. You can buy blackout shades. You can do everything right and, you know, give yourself 3 hours ritual before you go to bed and do all the right things. Turn the TV or
the warm milk.
Yeah, even the warm milk. Oh, we got to get back to that. And you still have this phenomena of insomnia. Yeah. So I think it might be the amygdala, you know, like...
We've talked about the amygdala, which is...
So we've only got 5 minutes left, but what would you suggest
to talk about, first of all, cognitive reshuffling, because this is a very important idea.
What would you suggest for somebody who is dealing with insomnia right now?
I'm gonna run through just a few steps so at least people can have that, and then we can talk about cognitive...
And then finally...
Yes. Okay, quickly. All right, first of all, when you really want to try to deal with insomnia, there are steps you can take. And one is to keep a regular schedule of your sleep and awakening. So you don't want to just go to bed at 2 in the morning and then the next night go to bed at 8 o'clock in the night.
Of course
not. So you want to keep a very regular schedule and try to, you know, if you can, wake up without an alarm.
And if you have a newborn, you know, they teach you, you got to put the newborn down the same time every night. Otherwise, it's
That's
havoc.
Right. Exactly.
So follow that advice.
Exactly.
Go to bed the same time every night. Go ahead.
Second one is that it may seem that it's counterintuitive, but do not sleep. Do not rest and get oversleep. People think that it's good to just sleep and sleep and sleep. It's not true.
It's
similar to the same idea that just stay regular and then your body will get what it needs.
Seven to nine hours for an adult?
Okay.
For adults.
Yes.
For preteens, it's 10 to 12. For infants, it's 14 to 17.
Right.
Anyway, keep going.
And the bedroom should just be for sleep and sexual intimacy, so to speak. It should not be for everything else. So try to eliminate everything that's in your bedroom that's really not related to sleep. Keep it cool. Keep it, you know, dark. Mm. Don't have the lights on. Don't do all sorts of work in your bed and do everything that you would do on your computer, all that stuff. So just keep your bedroom for sleep.
Mm. I like to say sleep is holy.
Right.
And you should let your... You should let your bedroom be a holy place.
You should
place.
Think of it as a little bit of like what we're talking about, a ritual, a sleep
ritual. Of course.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you should be excited to go to sleep.
Mm.
If you're thinking it's a chore, and I think most of the time that people have insomnia, and I'm not remembering what the actual name is, but most of the time it's because you're anxious about not sleeping.
Yes.
So you've now kind of talked yourself into a complete state about sleep for weeks, years, months, who knows.
And so you have a remedy for that, cognitive reshuffling,
but you'll
get to that.
Okay. And as I said, the environment is important. And finally, exercise in the beginning of the day. Don't exercise at night. It revs you up.
Right.
I know a lot of people that don't have time have to go to, you know, the gym after work.
Right, for hours after you exercise, your heart rate is elevated, your blood is flowing fast.
Yes.
And
how many hours?
For several hours.
Several hours.
Yeah, for something like 3 or 4 hours
so
after
So don't
exercise.
Jog in the evening.
No.
Right? Unfortunately, that's
don't,
the time
don't
when people
exercise,
do it.
Probably, I would say safely, after 4 o'clock.
Okay.
Do not have caffeine after probably 2. If you have any kind of insomnia, do not. I go through this with so many clients of mine.
Yeah, that must be a given.
Okay, so caffeine. Alcohol. Alcohol is not good for the quality of sleep. It might help you to get to sleep, but it really will not help the quality of your sleep. Mm. So really don't.
It'll interrupt your cycles.
It will.
I mean, the chemistry and needing to go to the bathroom or whatever, it will just burn off any kind of sleep cycle. So alcohol is not good.
Any kind of drugs. Even sometimes I think people think that marijuana helps, but it actually probably doesn't.
Sure.
It creates
dependency on it.
And So that and then
I'm
any
gonna add a couple hot warm milk.
I was gonna say
warm and why
so
warm,
what is the secret
well,
about the
milk,
hot
because
warm
milk has
Kevin.
Melatonin and we could have talked about melatonin
milk,
the whole
milk,
show.
Milk stimulates
and dairy products. Have melatonin in them. But
they don't have it in it. They just stimulate the release of the melatonin.
Oh, is that what it does? Okay.
And that's why
and
those
types. And you want
it
warm because
it activates
it's easier
the
to
enzyme.
Digest.
You're, that's
where
right.
Our body temperature is 98.
Bedtime tea, perhaps?
Well, actually, sleepy time tea would be a good idea.
Because it's not necessarily that it's doing anything chemically. It's just helping you with your ritual to relax. Mm-hmm. That's what the tea represents.
Slow it down.
Here's the other stuff. Come on.
Right.
Odors. Lavender.
Yes.
They say, you know, most lavender odors are most odors calming. Are interrupters of sleep. I mean, you know, if you smell bacon in the morning, you're going to wake up, you know, but you don't want that in your bedroom. But right. You do want things like lavender, or fresh apples, they're saying, cinnamon, certain yeah. things, certain odors will calm you down.
Perhaps and the odors sleep. That tend to relax people.
And better
in
yet, right. your partner's chamomile. Perfume on your pillow. You know, it really does work. Nice. It helps. So also a dimmer on your lights in your bedroom. So like at 7 o'clock, you could set the dimmer rather than have your typical lights in your bedroom.
Right.
Put a dimmer on your light switch. And then at 7, just put it halfway down and it will, you
help
know,
you. Yes.
Ready your brain. It'll tell your brain, okay, right. produce melatonin and start.
And let's just talk about melatonin one quick second, because I know a lot of people might be taking it.
Go ahead.
Really, the research states that you should take 0.3 milligrams of time-release melatonin, because if you take melatonin every night and you take a higher dose, it turns off your receptors in your brain, and they don't work any longer. So melatonin just for 2 or 3 nights is okay, but then it stops working. But
right.
if
you don't want to use it your whole life.
No, I mean, but if you take time release, it'll go across the whole night, and it will not be so much that the brain will turn its own melatonin production off.
0.3 is like the really.
What about a warm bath?
Yes, warm bath is very wonderful. It'll relax you. That's the point. You want to go into a peaceful state.
Yes.
Finally, you set your alarm by your cycle. So if you can only get 4 cycles a night, it's better than getting 4.5 cycles. So right. set your alarm or go to bed later.
Assuming a cycle will be anywhere from 80 to 100 minutes.
No, it's usually 90 minutes. It's really accurate. It's really not that. Yeah, as you get older, it might get down to 87 minutes or something.
Oh,
but
wow.
it's
very
really
specific.
Very yes. specific. And REM sleep typically often is very specific also, like 27 minutes.
For those of you who have iPhones and Android phones and smartphones, there are many, many apps. If you look up Sleep Cycle, that'll set an alarm based on your cycles and kind of watch it. It's very interesting stuff.
Oh, sure. The Fitbit will, if you're wearing your Fitbit at night, you can see the amount of sleep
put,
and arousal.
Put the screen off on the Fitbit, guys. Come on.
So get that blue light out of your bedroom, for
That's
sure.
Right.
Cover the cable box or whatever. And get a good night's sleep. Tomorrow is an exciting time. We're having a writer and director talk about a mental health series they're producing on YouTube. Stephanie, I have to thank you for this. We wanted to take callers about their nightly rituals.
There was too much to talk about.
There's way
today.
Too
it
much. You
wonderful.
Have to come back since you're a sleep technologist. You can get in touch with Stephanie here at the Positive Mind Center, 212-757-4488. And get information about sleep. So thank you so much for
great.
Being with us.
Great. It was great to
yes,
be
we'll
here.
We'll definitely have
back.
To be doing another show about sleep. There's
it's
so much to talk about.
One of the pillars.
Thank you so much for tuning in to The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. We'll be putting a little bit of special lullaby music.
It's 2 o'clock. Take your nap.
And here it comes. See you tomorrow.